Yom Ha'atzmaut Sameach, Rabbi Chaim Bravender, on Making Aliyah.
Go on Aliyah, don't go on Aliyah. Well, I thought about that. I guess it's because they've been to Israel before. You know, I came in Aliyah, I think I mentioned it. When I came in Aliyah, I had never been to Israel before I came on Aliyah. And it didn't occur to me that you're supposed to go to Israel to check it out. Because I was still young enough to imagine that for some reason you're supposed to go on Aliyah. So I went. And today, it's like the story of Terach and Abraham. You know, the first person who ever went on Aliyah was Terach. Terach, who at that time certainly was a bad guy. But sometimes bad guys do the right thing. He went Aliyah. But Hashem said to Avram Avinu, this is not right. There's something not right about this whole process, because Terach went on Aliyah because it was good for Terach. I mean, like, because he felt that he was in a bad situation and he could improve it by going on Aliyah. So Hashem said to Avram Avinu, this is not the way it's supposed to be. So Terach sort of died, or didn't die. You know, there's a problem in the in understanding the chronology, but in the Chumash he died. I mean, maybe he didn't die exactly. You know what I mean? Like, the story in the Chumash is also the story. And the story in the Chumash is that Terach died before Avram Avinu went to Eretz Canaan. And even though Rashi points out that this is a strange thing, because Terach seemed to be alive later on, okay, so it's strange. I guess he doesn't want to go on Aliyah. Yeah, it's like, you know, the babies always know when the situation is bad. So Terach wanted to go on Aliyah. So the story in the Chumash is that Terach went on Aliyah, but he died before he came to Eretz Yisrael. That's the story in the Chumash. Now, as I say, you know, sometimes the story as it's told doesn't reflect perfectly the chronology of things, because it seems that Terach was still alive in Eretz Yisrael, but that doesn't matter to me, because the story as it's told in the Chumash probably also means something. So what it means to me is that Terach was going to Eretz Canaan, but he was not going on Aliyah. He just happened to be going to a place where he thought things would be better for him. I guess it's similar to the Jews from France going to Poland. Like, you wouldn't call that Aliyah, right? Even though it worked out well for them on some level. But they weren't going on Aliyah. They weren't going to the place that they were supposed to be. They were just running away from the place which was not so conducive to them. So Terach was going to Eretz Canaan, but he wasn't going on Aliyah. He was just going to a place that was that he thought he might be able to, make a lot of money and you know, make a business or something. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Avram Avinu, let's get Terach out of the picture. He doesn't count. And in the Chumash killed him, so he's gone. And then HaKadosh Baruch said to Avraham Avinu, going on Aliyah means fulfilling a mitzvah. Now, you know that in the last 2,000 years, well, Jews are always, you know, are very interested in justifying themselves. And since they are great on casuistry, which is a word that I don't understand exactly, but it means something like tricky thinking. So Jews are good at tricky thinking. And one of the things that the Jews have enjoyed doing is saying that in spite of the fact that the Chumash, in the words of the Chumash, seem to indicate that there's an advantage to going to Eretz Yisrael, they have managed to explain to themselves that you really don't have to do that. Which is okay, you know. I mean, I wouldn't say it was the greatest moment of the Jewish people, but it was something that we do. We do that all the time. We sort of convince ourselves that It's not simple. Like, nothing is simple. Like, when you see something, it says, like it says in the Chumash, it says, Avram, go to Eretz Canaan. So we say, well, it's not so simple. And it doesn't mean what you think it means. It doesn't mean that you should go to Eretz Canaan. Maybe it means if your father's name is Terach, you should go to Eretz Canaan. Maybe it's like a limit. There's a limiting factor. Or there's some kind of question about whether going to Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah or not. Right? In other words, like you say, well, if living in Borough Park is not a mitzvah, and going to Eretz Yisrael is not a mitzvah, then there's no difference between living in Borough Park and living in Eretz Yisrael. Now, this is a kind of thinking that no healthy non-Jew would be able to understand, but which, for some reason, Jews have made a big point out of. You know, and we are, for us, it's very clear. To us, it's very clear that things don't mean what they seem. Things don't mean what they seem to say. And in spite of the fact that that the Torah says you should go to Eretz Yisrael, in spite of the fact that some Rishonim say it's a mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael, even b'zman hazeh, and generally we're used to being machmir, right? We want to be machmir to be yotze all the shitas. So if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you might be yotze a shita about a mitzvah that you're not yotze if you live in Borough Park. Nevertheless, dafki in this matter, we're willing to be mekel because, I don't know, the end of the sentence is not clear to me. But I guess people are like stones. You know, like if you are at rest, you prefer to stay at rest. You know, and since most of the Jewish people is overweight, so they probably would rather be at rest. So wherever they are, that becomes good. You know, it becomes good, and then people become very frum, and they say, I'll only go if the Mashiach takes me by the hand. You know, because I don't want the Mashiach to miss out. Because if I'm already in Eretz Yisrael, so what will the Mashiach do? I mean, he won't be able to bring me to Eretz Yisrael. So this becomes like a, you know, even a kind of a frum position. So that I think that Aliyah is something that people should do. People who read the Chumash should do what the Chumash says. And the Chumash seems to be very focused on Eretz Yisrael. And there's a bracha that we have today, and that bracha is that in spite of the fact that, you know, that there are difficulties in living here, and there are stresses that have to be overcome, which I suppose exist every place, but not having lived every place, I can't guarantee it. I think that that people should take the bracha. Like we have not been good at that. We haven't been good at just taking the simple brachas that are given to us at the time in which we live, but we're suspicious of them. We tend to be suspicious and say, you know, maybe it's too good. Maybe we don't really deserve it. Maybe it's not somehow we're running up the wall or bursting into uncharted territory or something of that sort. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that's a mistake. I think you have to take the bracha that's offered. And the bracha of Eretz Yisrael is an offering. I mean, it exists. Jews can live today any place. I mean, almost any place. At a lot of good places and do a lot of nice things. But they can also live in Eretz Yisrael. And even though I don't have the wherewithal to judge personally, it seems to me that the Torah indicates that you should live in Eretz Yisrael. I always point out, you know, the Rambam, who is accused of not thinking that going to Eretz Yisrael was a mitzvah. Of course, that can be understood in a variety of ways. As everybody knows, it's been, you know, Svarim have been written explaining how the Rambam, who didn't say something, meant it anyway. But there is no doubt. I mean, that's a shir. That's called a shir. But this is not a shir. But I say, you know, that the Rambam Hilchos Melachim says that with all the Tanoim used to come to Eretz Yisrael, they would fall, their Moroim, they would fall and kiss the ground of Eretz Yisrael. Like, he didn't say that when you go to Cordova, you should kiss the ground of Cordova. You know, even though it might be a nice place to live, and it might be a you know, the hotels might be really good and the service classy and the technology, you know, really up to date and all of that. But no one ever kissed the ground in Spain. So the same Rambam, who said, who didn't say it's a mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael, and you understand that that doesn't matter because nothing, because you can always turn it around to say the reason that he said it's a not a mitzvah is because it's the biggest mitzvah in the world, right? You know, so how could he include it in one of the 613? Because then it would just be one of the 613. But they're not including it. It meant it was like mitzvah start. It was like a starred mitzvah. Okay, that's enough. But what the Rambam did say is, he says, look, I want you to know that Eretz Yisrael is not like any place else in the world. Because the only place that you can come to and kiss the ground, this is difficult today since they put asphalt in Ben Gurion Airport. But they should have had, like when you get off the plane, they should give you like a little square someplace. Well, the old days, today you can't do it because you have these, what do they call those, charvulim, you know. Yeah, jetways. That jetway. Thank you very much. They have these jetways which, but you, I guess you can kiss a duty-free shop. which is indicative of the grandeur of the state of Israel. But in the old days, you used to go down the stairs. You got off the plane, you went all down the stairs, and you had to walk on the tarmac, whatever that is, and then go to a bus. So on the way to the bus, which of course, you know, there's always one bus for 400 people, and there were four other buses standing back there, and the people, instead of driving the bus, were drinking tea or something. So everybody's standing out in the heat waiting for these buses. While you're standing out in the heat, you could have kissed the ground, but they covered it all with asphalt. I guess you could kiss the asphalt, maybe be the Yevet. You get credit for kissing asphalt. That I don't know. That's like a hakira that I haven't noticed. But this is like the speculative, notion of coming at Aliyah. And I was in America, so I met a fellow that I knew many years ago, in YU, and he's a lawyer, very successful lawyer. You know, there was this case about some soldier, I don't know, remember exactly, was it a soldier in America wanted to wear a yarmulke, like take off his hat and wear a yarmulke, and it was, I don't know what happened, they arrested him or something for disturbing the peace, or peace of mind, or, it was like, you know, the army is a place where they don't know how to deal with deviants. Anytime you deviate, so like they don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with it. Everybody assumes that any deviation in the army must be usur. It's like a yeshiva, you know, basically. And if you don't do what everybody does, so you're probably doing something usur, right? That's like a very kind of simple position. So in the army, this guy's wearing a yarmulke at some place or other, so they arrested him. So this case was fought in court. I think Nat Lewin was involved. So this guy, this lawyer, well, not Nat Lewin. So this lawyer says to me, look at how great it is to live in the diaspora because you could fight for being Jewish. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, Nebuchadnezzar, you wear a yarmulke, like nobody cares. So I found it difficult to deal with this argument. I didn't know what to say. I simply didn't know what to say. You shouldn't go to Eretz Yisrael because it's easy to be a Jew there. You should be a Jew in a place where it's hard to be a Jew. You know, where you have to fight for every centimeter that you walk. And I say, so I said, okay. You know, I guess this is called the difficulties of the galut. You know, the difficulties of Eretz Yisrael is that you can wear a yarmulke and nobody bothers you. And the difficulties of the galut is that you think that that's bad. You know, that's the, like the, like everybody has their own. Has their own problems. You know, everybody always, the Mefarshim always talk about the bad things that happen to people because they live in the diaspora, because they're like overwhelmed by a different kind of way of thinking about things and looking at things. But I think it's true. I think it's, and I remember when we grew up, where I grew up, I mean, I grew up in a neighborhood that only had Jews in it. In Brighton Beach, there were 100,000 Jews, they say. I did not count them. And there is no census of Brighton Beach. But the banks that had a bank account for every single person in the town or in the area said there were 100,000 people who lived in Brighton Beach. And I think that they were all Jews. I never met a non-Jew in Brighton Beach. The only difference was some of them spoke Yiddish and some of them didn't. But they were all Jewish. I mean, in Brighton Beach, when I grew up, we always learned that the street didn't belong to us. The only Jews. You imagine only Jews in Brighton Beach. Not even, but yes, the street did not belong to you. So what did that mean? It means that on Shabbos morning. There was an institution in New York called Schoolyard. You know what a schoolyard is? Like you could play ball. You could play baseball or softball or it's a yard. And they used to keep it open on Shabbos, I think on Sunday also, so that the kids from the neighborhood could play ball on Shabbos when there was no school. So in the big schoolyard, which was near my house, Shabbos morning the schoolyard was taken over by black gangs that came from some other neighborhood. They used to come to my schoolyard. It wasn't mine because I didn't go to that school, but they used to come to my neighborhood schoolyard and take over. They wouldn't let us play. But so we learned that in this neighborhood in which I lived in which there were only Jews, 100,000 of them, right, that you couldn't go to shul. When you went to shul, you couldn't walk through the schoolyard as a shortcut because the black kids were playing whatever they were playing, and they didn't like little kids who looked Jewish, you know, because on Shabbos morning, we really looked Jewish. That was, you know, who wears a suit Shabbos morning? I mean, unless you're really committed to some foreign kind of religion. So the street, even the street in Brighton Beach, which was entirely Jewish and Yiddish-speaking, as I remember it, didn't belong to me. Like, I had to make sure that I didn't do the wrong thing, which would lead to a bad result. And Brighton Beach was in that time considered to be a very peaceful and quiet kind of neighborhood. But that's really the difference between living in Eretz Yisrael and living in Chutz La'aretz. And in Eretz Yisrael, for all its difficulties, you know, the street belongs to you. The streets belong to you. When I started going to the west side of Manhattan, you know, when I kind of outgrew Brooklyn a little bit, I was able to move up to the high-powered world of the west side of Manhattan. So I had a friend who lived in a building called the Schwab House, which is a very, very big apartment house. You know, just like in Brooklyn, it would be like a regular kind of nothing building. But in Manhattan, we had to pay thousands of dollars to rent the same crummy little apartment that in Brooklyn would cost you a lot less. But if you wanted to live in Manhattan, that was the deal. So the Schwab House was a very big apartment. It had a lot of entrances to it. It was like a block. It was a whole block. It had a lot of entrances to it. And in every entrance, they had some guy who didn't speak English, who wore a uniform and said hello to you and pointed to you at the elevator. I mean, this was, like, coming from Brooklyn, I couldn't understand why anybody would pay money for this service, and I always thought that you could probably find the elevator on your own, but apparently not. When you lived in Manhattan, you were totally incompetent. I was always dependent on somebody to show you where you should go. I guess even if you lived there, it didn't matter. And putting up a sign, elevator, with an arrow would not be acceptable. That would never work. So in this building, I had friends. So I used to visit my friends, and it was Shabbos. It was Shabbos, so the wife, mother of some little children who were like draying around and being very bored. American children are always very bored, and they're super bored on Shabbos. Shabbos is like the most devastating thing, because like you sit there and you look at the television and it's not on. You know, it's like you could see these kids going to catatonic withdrawal right before your eyes, right before your eyes. So the mother says to me, you have to excuse me, I'm taking my children to play with their friends. I said, oh, that's nice. And where are you taking them? So I assumed that the mother was taking her children to some neighbor, somebody who lived, you know, not too far away. And they'd have to cross the street or something like that. I mean, they were 8 years old or 9 years old. They'd have to cross the street. They crossed the street. So you need a parent to help you cross the street. So I said, okay, so I'll sit here and wait. When you come back, we'll continue doing whatever we were doing, whatever high-powered discussion we were involved in. So she says, no, I'm taking them to the neighbor, two floors up. I said, two floors up? Why can't the kids go themselves? It's in the same building, and you have these guys guarding the elevators at every entrance. She says, walk in the hall by themselves? Can't do that. Who knows what might happen? So I said, you know, in Israel, my kids play on buildings being built. I said, can you imagine that? You know, like in America, when they build a building, the first thing they do is build a big wall. And they put little eye holes in it. Right? And they say, it's like, say, you want to know what's on the other side of the wall? Here's the eye hole. That's as close as you'll ever get. Everybody building the building, you know, looks like he's doing something very important. You know, they have all these hard hats and like lights coming out of the hats and wires and all this kind of stuff. And you never, would never go into a building site. My kids, they didn't have when we moved into the house we lived in then, there was no playground yet. Because, you know, playgrounds in Israel come like 30 or 40 years after the oldest people in the neighborhood die. You know, so it's not like a high priority, thing. So they used to play in the building, I said, what a world, like, it's a different world. My kids think that they own the neighborhood. I mean, they may not, you know, but they think they do. And they think they can go anywhere they want in that neighborhood. Your kids can't walk up two flights in the building because it's foreign territory. It's you walk out of the door of your house. And I think that that's, you know, a primary distinction between life in the diaspora, which is very good sometimes, and enables you to kind of be Jewish and Jewishly creative and make, build buildings and other kinds of fortresses against the outside influences. But what Eretz Yisrael gives you is ownership. It gives you ownership of the air, and ownership of the streets, and ownership of the enterprise, right? Ownership of the enterprise, which doesn't mean that it's always successful, it always does what it should do, it always makes us happy, but it gives us ownership. I mean, it's very hard to imagine that that a Jew in America, an Orthodox Jew, when a Jew is, you know, concerned about maintaining a different lifestyle than the American lifestyle, whatever that is. I mean, I say America because that's where I come from, but I'm sure it's more true even in other places than it is in America. At least America that I know, which is New York City, and New York City is kind of considered to be a liberal and open place, at least, you know, if you relate it to Oakland, California, or to John Birch territory in Southern California. But in New York, it's like, you know, people just kill each other there, but they're not prejudiced. they kill each other for good reasons. They want money. They're drug addicts. I mean, you know, it's not a prejudice thing. It's like just practical. I mean, how else can you make money without paying income tax? You know, So you steal. I mean, that's a simple matter. I mean, it's very straightforward. It's very reasonable. So Eretz Yisrael today. I mean, Eretz Yisrael today. Even though, you know, everybody talks about the fact that it's hard to give it an exact halachic, the godless of Eretz Yisrael is that, you know, it's hard to define it halachically, which has, you know, tremendous advantages. But there's no doubt that Eretz Yisrael is a place where all the people who live therein, whoever they are and whatever their notions and ideas are, have to work together to some extent to make it happen. Right? There has to be. There's no. You know, on many levels, there is us and them in Eretz Yisrael as well. You know, religious, non-religious Jews. You know, tall people and short people. It's like, you know, you have to. Everybody likes to be distinguished. Everybody likes to have a group. Everybody likes to be on a team. And you know, in Eretz Yisrael, all the teams are also political, and that's, to my mind, a little unfortunate, often very unfortunate, sometimes a little unfortunate. But there's another level of life to Eretz Yisrael. There's another level of life to Eretz Yisrael, and that is that it's the only place in the world today where Jews, as Jews, you know, with all the distinctions that they may bear, and all of the ideologies that they may profess, and all of the concerns that they might think about as individuals, have common goals that are overwhelming. You know, they have to preserve themselves. They have to build together, you know, a viable kind of economy. They have to move somehow in the right direction, to educate their children to be reasonable people, and to accept the burden of reasonable ideals. And this is something that exists only in Eretz Yisrael for the Jewish people. And everybody builds their own school. You build the school, it's my school for my kids and kids like him. And then you build your own shul, and it's a shul for me, and everybody's like me. And people who are not like me pretty much are not going to go to my shul. And because I think that these distinctions are of such great importance, you know, my shul, I'm not going to have anything to do with the other guy's shul. I might not even go to a simcha that's organized by somebody who goes to the other shul because I'm in my shul, right? And so you lose track of the commonality, except, interestingly enough, I think around Eretz Yisrael, that even in Chutz La'aretz, Eretz Yisrael is a kind of is a force that enables a lot of different kinds of people to get together, but not like in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, the glory of Eretz Yisrael today, the glory of it, to my mind, is that on some level, there's a point where in real time, and for real issues and real events, we're in it, all of us are in it together. Right? We're all in it together. We're saving ourselves together, we're building together, we're making some things, or we're not doing it at all. So I think that that Aliyah is not just about, do I like it? I mean, it's true, you know, I grew up in a kind of lower middle class home where I was taught the Protestant ethic and that you have to go to work because you have to go to work. That's what my parents taught me. I was not such a good student. But this was like, you know, psychologically impressed upon me that you have to, that even if you suffer, you have to do it anyway. You know, like that was the position. That was the position. So I understand, you know, people are, I say, well, okay, I don't want to go to Eretz Yisrael because it's not as good for me as it is. But it probably is as good. It's probably even a little better. You have to be able to think about it, you know, in the right way. And when I combine the fact that it seems to me that the Torah wants me to go to Eretz Yisrael, and that there's a commonality of interest here that goes way beyond anything that the Jewish people have ever known in the diaspora. Because in the diaspora, all the people who are not of that kind, not willing to make that the effort to remain Shomrei Mitzvahs, they all disappeared. And in Eretz Yisrael, they're not going to disappear. And that creates a lot of challenges for the people who are religious. I mean, we've ignored them up to now, largely but perhaps because of the other difficulties in Eretz Yisrael. You know, like we have wars and we have enemies, and so we tend to overlook the problems of the commonality of interest on a philosophical level. Like, what does that mean? What does it mean that I'm in it with all the people who are not interested in the Torah and they're not interested in Mitzvah? It has to mean something. Like, everybody understands that Rav Kook made many attempts to kind of resolve this problem for himself. And some of his Talmidim have adopted, you know, his positions, even though they're not always, you know, Rav Kook's positions are often poetic, which means that that it's hard to understand them precisely. It's hard to know what they mean in a particular new case, right? It's not like halacha where you spend all your time saying, if the halacha is A, then in new situation A prime, I would resolve it this way. But Rav Kook's positions are often poetic, which means that they're very difficult to classify halachically or give very precise parameters. Nevertheless, there's a certain direction there that the problem has to be worked on. We have to search for answers to questions that only exist in Eretz Yisrael, because in the diaspora, it's easy enough. All I say is that, well, if somebody's not from, he's going to assimilate. There you go. That's sort of like a justification for not relating too much to those people who are, in any event, choosing to leave. But in Eretz Yisrael, people don't assimilate. They remain Jews, and they remain identified. They identify themselves strongly as Jews, even though they have no component of Torah and mitzvahs at all. They don't. And this is a challenge that we have. You know, as we get the street. We get the street here in Eretz Yisrael, but we have also the challenge to deal with. So I think that the challenge is worthy. It's a worthy challenge. I think that the situation in the diaspora is not as fulfilling, because this challenge doesn't exist. Basically, people write off all the Jews who are not like them, you know, exactly, who are not willing to come into their fortress. And I feel that you lose out. You know, it's the fact that you're not able to communicate with people who are not exactly the same as you are. I mean, anybody who's been in the army in Israel knows that, at least knows, but I always thought it was a great experience for me. I mean, to meet people who couldn't even imagine what I was talking about. They couldn't imagine why anybody would want to get up to daven. I mean, they knew about it, but they just couldn't imagine it. You know, they couldn't imagine, here I'm standing with this guy, and he's defending me, and I'm defending him. I could owe him my life. You know, he's a Jew, I owe him my life. He doesn't know why you put on tefillin in the morning. I mean, that's a challenging kind of a situation. I mean, it's not like, look, in America, you know, so I was in New York, and I was going someplace. You know, in New York, the big thing today is they daven mincha. Like, that's a big thing. Used to be, when New York, you had to say, where's there a shul? Where's there a shul? And you go to shul, you daven mincha, right? But in Manhattan today, in New York, you say, you go on the street, and you say, you find a guy who looks Jewish, you say, where's the mincha? And he says, oh, in this store, and that store, and that store, and the other store. Like, every store, if you don't have mincha in the store, you're sort of like, it's embarrassing. Like, how can you not have mincha in the store? So I was walking down the street, looking for mincha, and I see this Lubavitcher mitzvah tank. I mean, I didn't know exactly what it was, because it was painted psychedelically. Usually it just has very simple kind of mitzvah tank, it says. But this was a psychedelic mitzvah tank. So I didn't get in first. I see these two Lubavitcher guys. You know, Lubavitchers take great pains to be identifiable. Like, if you're a Lubavitcher, you look that way. And if you don't look that way, you're not a Lubavitcher. It's not like, you know, there's no incognito with those guys. You know, they look the way they look. So I see three Lubavitchers standing out. They're all screaming at me, mincha. So I say, where's mincha? In the psychedelic mitzvah tank. Okay. We go in, so they grab guys off the street. They didn't want anybody who knew how to daven mincha. This is like a rule. If you know how to daven mincha, they say, no, it's not for you. Go to the other place. So I was standing there. They daven mincha. So I'm sure that, you know, you get a guy. Like, they make this tremendous effort. He gives me a card. On the card, it says where the psychedelic mitzvah tank parks each day. Because they go, they park. I don't know how they do it in Manhattan. If you imagine parking, a bunch of parking someplace in Manhattan. And they just stand there. I don't need to get tickets. I guess the guys who give out the tickets also have a mincha or something. So he gives me a card. The card says where he's parked every single day. So I said, okay, you know, you could do things like that. You could do things like that. But it's still, it's a certain anonymity. You know, you ask these people in the midst of psychedelic mid, were you here yesterday? Usually that mincha, no. Yes, you know, it's like cute. Like, they do it sometimes. But most people who are not into doing mitzvahs, are liable to assimilate. You know, and they're nervous about it. They're nervous that their children and their grandchildren will assimilate. There's no way in America to stop that from happening. So, the opportunities in Eretz Yisrael are grander. Even if what you see yourself doing is explaining yourself for the rest of your life, in Eretz Yisrael, the opportunities are a lot grander, a lot more significant. It's very important, you know, I mean, you know, I would say, the Chofetz Chaim, you know, the Chofetz Chaim wrote a book called Machaneh Yisrael. Wrote a book, and the book was directed to soldiers, Jews who were soldiers in the Russian army. And this was like a big chesed that the Chofetz Chaim did, because it was understood that if you were in the Russian army, that was the end of being Jewish. I mean, you couldn't be Jewish. You know, in the Russian army, they went in for 15 years, and they never went home. There were no vacations. You didn't, like you were in Vladivostok, and getting to Moscow would take you 7 days, so they gave you a day off, one day. So, of course, these people, you know, and they always put you in the army very far away from wherever you came from. That's how the Russian army works. So the Jews, the feeling was that if they caught somebody, they caught a Jew, they got him into the army, and he was in the army, that was the end of his being Jewish. The Chofetz Chaim wrote this book, Machane Yisrael, which is about how to be Jewish in the army, how to remain a Shomer Mitzvah in the Russian army. It was a great chesed. In the introduction, the Chofetz Chaim writes, he says, like, I know it's how difficult it is and how problematic being in the army is, but we don't lose faith, and we're with you, and we'll try to help you, and this is what you should do, and that's why I wrote the book, right? I mean, that's this book called Machane Yisrael. So if you brought the Chofetz Chaim today to the Israeli army, and you said the Chofetz Chaim, he says, look, you say to him, what kind of chickens do you want? What kind of chicken do you want to eat? What hechsher do you want? And he said, blah. I said, okay, the army will get you that hechsher. What kind of fruits and vegetables do you want? The army will get you that as well. You want a matzah, you want mulav and esra, you know, everything you want, the army will get you. We'll get you according to you. The army will not tell you. The army today, the Israeli army will not say, we don't do that. You know, like Israelis are wont to do. This is what we do. You don't like it? Don't eat. Right? That's a typical kind of Israeli response. But I remember when I was in the army, the latter part of my career, when I was a Rav Tzvai, the first part of my career, I was, of course, a secret commando. Got the biggest laugh of the morning. That's pretty good. Look, when I went into the army, you know, but the first day they call it Bakum, where they induct you. You know, there's you know that Woody Allen, Arlo Guthrie, is that who it is? Arlo Guthrie song? They induct you. So they induct you into the Israeli army. They give you an injection, and they give you a pair of socks. They give you a pair of socks. The only thing you ever get in the Israeli army is a pair of socks. And then they give you boots, but the boots are no good. So it's like not really getting anything. They don't fit, or they're not your size, or they're old, and they're supposed to be new, you know, the boot. But the socks, brand new. Brand new pair of socks. It's like worth going all the way to Tel HaShomer just to get a pair of socks, because it's the last thing you'll ever get. Right? That's it. So I went into the army. They asked me, they said, what do you want to do? So I said, Commando Yami. So the girls started laughing. So I said, what are you laughing about? What? You know, Commando Yami are the, what do they call it in America?
Seals,
right, the Navy SEALs. The Navy SEALs. I said, I want to be a Navy SEAL. So she starts laughing. These little girls, like 18 years old. I said, what are you laughing about? So she says, you're old enough to be my father. I said, well, so are most of the Commando Yabi guys. You know, she was like, she looked like she was must have been 18, but she looked like she was 12. So this is lack of belief in my early career has been expressed previously. You know, even on the first day of my induction into the Israeli army. But now I've lost. I mean, I keep telling the stories, and I lost track. How did I get to the army? To the Commando Yami, what?
The
Chofetz Chaim. No, I mean, can you imagine, even when I was in the army, I was a Rav Tzvai, and we used to get anybody wanted anything, I would get it for him. There was no problem getting glatt kosher meat, there was no problem getting fruits and vegetables that were Shemitah approved by the Badatz. I didn't have any problem, with anything. You know, anything to do with religion, you know, it was not a problem. When I was in basic training, they told us you had to stay for Shabbos. It's something called Shmirat Basis. Shmirat Basis means you don't do anything, but you have to be where some annoying person can see you. That's called Shmirat Basis. So they put you in a room, and you're theoretically watching guarding the base. But since they don't let you have bullets, it's not clear what it is you're guarding from. So if you see if some Arab happens to come in and you see him, I guess it was to swing at him with your rifle, because you don't have bullets. Okay? You're not up to that level yet where you're going to have bullets. So the guy, the Mem Kaf is an 18-year-old who's given authority that he doesn't know how to deal with. Right, that's called a Mem Kaf. You know, all the Mem Kafim are candidates for a psychologist's couch. You know, they should all be in analysis, but they're not. They're in charge of you, like they're in charge of me. This guy, this kid who's 18 years old, totally out of his depth. He doesn't know anything about people. He's in charge of my life. So the Mem Kaf comes over to me. He wants to show that he's a big thing. He says, "Look, I know you have to go daven mincha. I know you have to go daven Friday afternoon." There was the Shmirah starts Friday night and when it gets dark. So he says, "I know," showing his worldliness, "that you," meaning me, "have to daven." So that's Yichlit Palel. I said, "Yes." So he says, "Well, how much time do you want?" I was already out of his level of competence. How much time do you want? Like, what did he mean? He says, because he knew I was going to go daven in the shul. He was going to daven in the shul. And the shul was the one place that he would never enter. He wouldn't go into. Here's a guy who's like into witchcraft. He could not understand like what would happen to him if he would go into shul. So he was sending me. He was sending me to some level of independence that no other person in the unit ever achieved. I was going to go to the shul. I was going to the shul. So he said to me, "How long does it take for you to litpalel ayom ba'erev?" So I didn't know what to say. So I said, 3 hours. So he said, "Beseder, take 3.5." In other words, he let me out of the first group. The first group that was doing shmirah, I was excluded because I had to go to daven. I had to go late to Balel. So you see, I failed my own drasha at that time. Because I said that one of the great things about Eretz Yisrael is that you can integrate the effort with the people who don't know what you're doing. But here I took advantage of it. And I didn't tell them it takes 15 minutes to daven. I said, "I'll take the 3.5. You know, I take the 3.5 out." But you see, then you see that there are issues. You know, there are issues, but the Chofetz Chaim, I think the Chofetz Chaim would be astounded to discover that doing mitzvahs in the Israeli army is not a problem. The only problem is getting the other people to do the mitzvahs, getting the people who never did mitzvahs to do the mitzvahs. When I was a soldier, I mean, all these things are, you know, they almost make me believe that the Baal Tshuva movement might have some positive aspects to it, which I generally don't believe. But when I was in the army, I was a regular soldier. I was a regular soldier. Being a regular soldier is the worst of the worst. It's the pits. It's nothing worse than being regular anything. And I spent a lot of time trying to get out of that status, of that classification. And I did it by taking courses, which is very good. Courses are very good. Yeah, I took a course in first aid. I took a first aid course. I took a course in driving zachlamim, which is comes in very handy, you know, all the time if you know how to drive a zachlam. Zachlam is an armored troop carrier. But there are two kinds. They're half tracks and with wheels, right? So the ones with half tracks, you need a special license to drive the half track. You know what a half track is? Like it has wheels in the front and tracks in the back, like you have on a tank. You know, tanks have tracks that go around like this. So a half track has tracks in the back and the front they have wheels. Now to drive a half track armored troop carrier, you need a special driver's license, which is a very good. So I can tell you a story about that, which is really terrific. So I used to go to that. I used to take any course I could get into, because I had a hope that I would get to some kind of job where I would be independent. But it didn't work out. The only job I could get where I would be an independent in the army is being a rabbi. Because nobody likes to push around rabbis. I mean, even people not religious. Don't push around, Rabbi. So a rabbi could always say, oh, I have a very important meeting in Tel Aviv. And they believe you. It makes sense to them that a rabbi should have a very important meeting to go to in Tel Aviv. So you can do that. But that's another story. But I'm telling you about the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim, who died about 1933, which is not so long ago. In his world, it was impossible to be frum on any level in the army, in the Russian army. And it was not conceivable. It didn't matter what you did, you could not be frum. And in the Israeli army, I mean, it's a fact that being religious gives you the upper hand. They can't tell you that you can't be religious. So even if you come up with some kind of crazy minhag, like you do it this way. Like some Lubavitcher guy will come and say, like he's out in the middle of nowhere in Sinai, in a sand dune, and he says, look, I've got to go to the mikveh. If I don't go to the mikveh, I can't function for the rest of the day. So they say, well, what do you need? Well, I need an armored convoy to take me to a large body of water. So I'm like, okay. You're on your way. They get it for you. It's not even a question. As long as you say it's religious. Like if a guy came and said, look, I want to go swimming. I swim every day. Forget it. No, when you say you want to go to a mikveh, you are oppressing the army. I mean, they will do something. They'll give in. They'll give in to you. You say, you're out in the middle of nowhere. And you say, you're going to be there for Shabbos. In the middle of nowhere. You say, you need an Eruv. You need an Eruv. You don't have to make the Eruv. Suddenly there'll be a team of people who are making an Eruv. Either under your direction or anybody else's direction that you want. But you'll get your Eruv. Right? There's no other thought. So you imagine, this is what happened. This is what happened in Israel. This is because of the fact that in the army, at least in a lot of moments in the army, the integrated principle works very well. People do things together. The fact that they have this background or that background doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor or if you're an officer or if you're a machine gunner. I mean, it all doesn't matter because the whole thing is not going to work at all unless the people involved are working together. So this, the Chofetz Chaim, we told the Chofetz Chaim. I mean, same thing's true of the American Army. The American Army is an orthodox person, the American Army, so they send them packages. It has food in it. I guess they know how to package very cleverly, open it up, and it has all the basic needs for the religious soldier in Burma or something. It's all there. But you can't eat with anybody else. You can't take it. You have to hide. You have to be in your own space. And that it's not it doesn't bother me that the guy's uncomfortable or he feels badly about it, but it's a waste. Instead of being active about what you're doing, about being about showing yourself, as being something one thing or another, what you're doing is finding a way to devalue it. Right? Just like they devalue it, you devalue it yourself. So I think that living in Israel is a great thing. It's a great option. I'm very happy that over the years I had a chance to go over some of the lists of names of people who've been to yeshiva, that many, many people have opted to stay in Israel for one reason or the other. And that makes me happy, even though I know that in truth I can't take credit for it, but I'll take credit for it anyway. And I hope that the future will not be worse than the past, and that since it is a great place to live, people will take it up and take up the option and try to come to Eretz Yisrael. Have a nice day. It's Yom HaTzvot.